ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How long do you spend staring at screens each day? Is it too much? Is it something you're worried about? This week on Download This Show, screens, like them or not, have become the cornerstone of our digital lives. But with virtual reality and endless streaming services and even wearable technology, the way we interact with the digital world through screens could be about to change drastically. This week on the show, we are doing a deep dive into the future of screens. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell and welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed, it is a brand new episode of Download This Show. Joining us from the University of the Sunshine Coast, apparently the is optional, lecturer in computer science, Erica Mealy. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And award-winning freelance technology journalist. She made me put in the award-winning.
I did.
That's not.
Not
something I volunteered. We have Alice Clark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
The backstory to this is that immediately before she's the show, she's like, you don't have to call me award-winning. And I'm like, well, now that I've said it, it's going to stick. Here we go. We are dedicating this episode to screens. Screens of all sizes, big ones, small ones, and ones that are disappearing into your eyeballs. And we're going to start with, I guess, what would have to be the biggest screen in our lives, generally speaking, in our homes, which is, of course, the television screen. And believe it or not, a war has been brewing over the last couple of years as to which streaming services, which broadcasters have prominence on the screens that you have in your living room. Alice, you're at a launch for a service that at least is claiming, amongst other things, to help put a detente on this particular conflict. Walk me through what you saw.
So I went to the launch for Hubble. And it was a very pretty location. There was every single celebrity that you vaguely recognized from that episode of That Block that one time. And delicious scallops. I really have to call out the scallops. But mostly it was just an event kind of talking about how great it is that there is this new box that you can sign up to different streaming platforms and get discounts and it'll suggest you what to watch. And very carefully, they didn't mention that it's a Foxtel company, which I found quite interesting. But basically, Hubble is a box which allows you to watch all your different streaming platforms and free-to-air channels and other channels in the one place, and it'll suggest you content from all of them on the one page.
So this comes against a backdrop, right, where there's been increasing debate over which services get prominent access on TV manufacturers. And actually, it's worth pointing out, Erica, it seems like manufacturers have been playing hardball with broadcasters as to who actually gets to have their logo when you buy a new TV. Isn't that right?
They have, actually. And the SBS is kind of refused to play hardball and then being buried down the bottom because they refuse to have a 15% share of their advertising go through to a company that was going to have them showcased. So the idea that you have to pay to be available it's completely against the idea of free-to-air that we have already in Australia. So it's good that we're actually starting to deal with that.
And we're talking about like 15% to a manufacturer, like to the people that are actually building just the screen, which is a hectic amount of money for people that build hardware. It's different if it's a service that operates an ongoing like store, like say Apple or Android, which also makes similar-ish demands in different ways, shapes and forms. But that was one of the things that came out of a recent occurrence. That was something that came out of recent occurrences down in Canberra. So let's just circle back to Hubble for a second here. Hubble is not by any means the only service that is trying to bring together the multiple different streamers and broadcasters into a single portal, as it were. So certainly Fetch has been around. Why are so many of them suddenly popping up, really, is the question, Alice.
Yeah, I got to say, when I first saw Hubble, my response was, oh, so like an Apple TV.
It even looks a bit like an Apple TV.
It really does, but it's cheaper.
It really does.
But it's because there's now so many different platforms. Like you'll remember back in 2015, it was hailed as, there is now one streaming service, so you can sign up to it and no one has to pirate ever again. And then a few months later, it's like, there's now two streaming services. But if you sign up to both of them, you have access to all the content and you never have to pirate ever again.
And now there's 43 streaming services. And yeah, Pirating now seems better than ever.
It's quite popular, got to say. I've seen it on the internet. I would never do it myself.
Legal,
no, not legal. We should never do it.
No, we would never encourage that. But I mean, interestingly, like when Netflix first came out, we were very much geo-blocked. They talked about the fact that what was on Netflix in the US wasn't what we got down here. So then we had a whole, you know, organization sort of running down through the cobwebs in the shadows to be able to help Australians just get similar access. And the fees we pay down here are exorbitant compared to the United States. But slowly we're getting more and more. And this idea of sort of ease of use is the goal. But I don't really agree. They've come out and said that they're Australia's newest transformative TV technology, which if it's just kind of copying something else, I'm not really sure that's true transformation.
It's also existed in the UK for quite a while as Sky TV and Sky Box. And over there it's available as a subscription.
So we've basically just circled back around to having cable bundles, essentially.
It is exactly a cable bundle, and it's sold by Foxtel. And so you can, if you bundle your streaming services through Hubble, you get a discount based on how many you get, which is similar to Optus SubHub and Amazon Prime. It's just taking us back to the days of bundles. However, what is interesting is that in the US, more and more of the kind of studio-owned streaming services are starting to acknowledge the fact that it is not very profitable to have this incredibly fractured market. It was quite profitable to have their shows on Netflix, but having to run their own streaming service is not very profitable if not actively losing money. So over there, we're slowly seeing the streaming services contract again. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that goes here and what sort of difference that makes to offerings like Hubble.
So the way it would work currently, to take Hubble as an example, and we will compare it to the competitors in a second, but it does aggregate a whole bunch of different apps together. We're talking about Netflix, Disney+, Prime Video, Binge, KO, Lifestyle, Flash, YouTube, ABC iView, Optus Sport, ABC Kids, and so on and so forth. I love that they've separated iView and ABC Kids. Anyway, so it brings them all together. Now, some of those are obviously free, like your ABCs and SBSs and 7 Pluses, and some of those are paid for. In aggregate, are you actually saving any money?
Depends on if you would have subscribed to all of those services anyway.
Mm.
But if you subscribe to, I think it's like if you subscribe to three, you get 5% off or 5-10% off. I haven't done the briefing yet, so I don't know the full things off the top of my head at the moment. But you get a bit of a discount. So if you were going to subscribe to them anyway, yeah, it does save you some money. And also I like that it surfaces them all on the same screen with the same weight as your linear free-to-air channels and the Foxtel channels that come in your Binge subscription, which I did not realize you got Foxtel channels in your Binge subscription.
So, okay, so there are things like this. I mentioned Fetch earlier. Fetch is it's a slightly bigger box, and through which you can record TV, you can pause TV, you can watch most of the streaming services. Mm. Is there any difference, apart from the aggregate cost potential, is there any difference you can see, Erica, in why one might be better than the other?
Well, one of the claims to fame with Hubble is that you'll be able to watch the free-to-air channels, not just their apps, without an antenna. So at the moment, my understanding is the Fetch box, and certainly that's how it works in my house, is you plug the antenna into the back and it does the digital TV guide, the same way we have our free TV Australia type ones on many of our different manufacturers. But they're going to be stripping out kind of the sort of the broadcast, they call it the BVOD, broadcast video on demand, part of that signal so that you can watch it more like the live channel, except that there's going to be some questions. So free-to-air can show some things that aren't included in the app, such as cricket and AFL this year, but they're not going to be in the app, so it's not going to be the same. So it's an interesting one. And the other thing with this bundling and discounting that they're talking about, there's kind of two tiers that they're talking about. So there's some that they call stack and save, and then there's others that aren't included. But they're hoping that people will get the saving from one and encourage them to get the other. So they're kind of like, I don't know, they're finding an addict and then just like putting a smorgasbord in front of them to try and get people to spend more, which is not great in a cost of living crisis, I don't think. I've restricted my house to three. We only have three services because it's too much. Which you can't keep up on what's on the wall.
Okay, let's just take a step out of Hubble in particular. What does this move and the moves that we're seeing over in the UK, you mentioned the Sky example and things also like Fetch back here in Australia, what do all of these services tell us about where that big screen that we have in people's living rooms, what does it tell us about where that is going, what it's about to become next?
I don't think it tells us anything about that. I think it tells us that these kinds of services think they can make some money off selling you streaming services, like they're going to get a cut. Like I don't think Hubble and boxes like Hubble is about trying to revolutionize the TV experience or democratize stream services or whatever. I think it's about taking that 10 or 15% cut off how much you're paying the streaming service.
Erica, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they're relying on the fact that convenience is key, and perhaps our younger generations don't remember that whole, you know, you had to change from TV to VCR or recorder and you had to use the functions on the television with multiple inputs. And, you know, my kids these days get cranky when you can't pause the television. We're at a friend's house and they're like, I need to go to the bathroom. Can you just pause the TV? And they're like, No, this is a live game and there's no set-top box. We can't pause real life. So I think, unfortunately, it's not to my mind, it's not a great statement about, I don't know, the attention spans maybe or the willingness for discomfort maybe. Like, let's look at how to make things the easiest way possible. But from the practical perspective, Disney Plus wasn't on Fetch for a little while and we did watch it less, because we had to go out through the Chromecast or we had to go out to another device. So, I mean, maybe they're trying to get people to subscribe or, you know, if it's on your screen, it's a lot easier to just go, oh, yeah, I really did want to watch that. Oh, yeah, another subscription. That's fine. So take that critical thinking out of it by making it more convenient.
Download This Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. We are dedicating this episode to screens and we're going in descending order. So we've had the big TV screens and then we're moving on to smaller screens like phones and tablets. Now, Alice, intriguing research that was released not that long ago, pulled together data from 2,441 studies involving more than 1.9 million children and teenagers to ask the question, is the concept of screen time functionally broken? Now, if you've got children of the age where they use devices where you're constantly in a tussle over, like, how much time should you be on a screen? And there's been a prevailing view that extended usage of screens up close is not necessarily the best for people's cognitive development. The question is that actually true, Alice?
The answer is maybe.
Conclusive. Excellent. That's what I like.
Yeah. So it all comes down to apparently the quality of the screen time, not necessarily the length of the screen time. Like, and it depends on if the parents are watching with the child.
They're almost definitely never watching with the child. I'm sorry, but like the device is there so one of us can go cook dinner. Like that's the reality. There are some interesting things in terms of like the ages at which it has an impact. And you're right, the context as well. So like at a certain point in ages under four, there are some suggestions that there are impacts on cognitive development. But after that, it becomes more nuanced. As you say, it is more about what are they doing? What are they consuming? What parts of the brain is it engaging? It actually is less cut and dry than it seems, right, Alice?
Yes. And there was also that thing from the e-safety commissioner a few weeks back who came out and said, yeah, actually screen time might not be too bad, particularly video games, given that video games are now often the third space for kids. So it used to be the mall or the park. But now the mall shut down and the park's a bit sketchy and we're all helicopter parents. And so the place where kids are hanging out with their friends is in games. Now, there is also research showing that giving kids unfettered access to algorithmic-based content has a similar reaction to your 70-year-old racist uncle having unsupervised access to algorithmic content on YouTube, which is that it will radicalize them and make them a bit weird. But if you watch with them, it might be okay.
Mostly because you spend the whole time going, oh, no, I don't think that's right. No. I'm quite sure that the Earth isn't flat and Australia does exist. Yes, definitely.
What stood out to me out of the reporting of this particular research is actually the time. Time is perhaps not the most effective mechanism through which we should be looking at this technology. It's a useful way of managing it in that you have X amount of time with a device and then it goes away. But actually, it perhaps doesn't deal with how psychologically hooked we get on these, the things that we do on these devices with our games or YouTube or, you know, talking to your friends. It perhaps doesn't deal with that aspect. And sometimes that contributes to why the extrication of the devices or trying to manage relationship with devices is actually a lot harder and more complicated than it initially seemed.
One other thing that stood out to me was that in a lot of these studies, they didn't talk about the context of how these children and also in some of the other adults were using the screen time. So I often think back to a study that I read a while ago about how there was a bunch of kids showing up to kindergarten who had been raised on iPads and didn't have the muscles in their hand to hold a pencil to learn how to color and write because they'd just been on their iPads the whole time.
There's another one. They've actually found that because the kids have their heads down at a particular angle, they're developing like an actual lump on the back of their neck because the vertebrae are actually moving because of how we're sitting. And so that's a really interesting one as well to do with how we actually regulate it and how they watch it. But I found it fascinating because I was one of those, you know, I'm going to be a good mum. I didn't have my toddlers or my computers and all that sort of stuff. But when one of my youngest was seeing a occupational therapist, she was actually saying that at times the screen time or the tablet time for her, it was an opportunity for escape and it helped her regulate her emotions. So sometimes the screen time is as good for them as it is for us because they can take their big feelings and kind of just space out with, you know, My Little Pony or whatever they're watching. But it's all about knowing what they're watching and make sure it's appropriate because, yeah, there's been some rather peculiar play that's happened afterwards. It's like, why is the pony jumping off a cliff?
Normal little girls playing.
It is, though, but you're like, what did you watch for that to come up? But the interesting part I've seen in the story is that social media is bad, which I think we knew that, right?
Yeah, I didn't need a research to tell me that part.
I didn't need research to tell me that, but, you know, it was consistently bad.
Yeah.
There was no potential benefit. And as a parent of a teenage girl, it's a scary place for them, actually kind of helping them navigate that. I think it's quite good that they've found that that's a consistent message that's come out of all of these. But then the idea that the video games are giving them the social connection, but the social media is bad, it's almost an interesting question for us. So where does that line sit? They can talk to one another while they play a game, but they shouldn't talk to one another sending reels. What's that difference and how do we actually make that a better, more easy to navigate thing for parents?
Your point kind of goes back to what I was trying to say, like about the context. Like we know social media is bad, but are we escaping into social media and the social media is making us depressed? Or are we already depressed and then hiding in social media to try and make ourselves feel better?
I don't know, but I feel like somebody should make a TikTok about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure there probably already is one.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, in my household, social media is bad because teenage girls can be catty. I think it's just that they're like that at school. Unfortunately, now they get to bring it home. And it's not the case that back in the day, okay, get off the phone now. Like it's your dad's turn to talk to someone or his dad needs to go on the internet. It was all very singular and it was serial and it was controlled. And these days they have their phones and they're in their rooms. And you're like, didn't you go to bed an hour and a half ago? Why are you sending me memes on Instagram? Go to bed, child.
I mean, I think one of the other challenging things is that at a certain point, with kids, they can see that you're constantly on your phone and you have no leg to stand on, like none at all. So it's like, and then you're like, well, I'm doing work. I'm like, in what ways Pinterest work? was a direct quote from a 9-year-old to me the other day. I was like, fair. I have no defense here. We cannot leave the show without talking what is beyond the screens that we currently know. So certainly there has been a lot of attention on virtual and augmented reality. We know Apple have made a big play in the space with their exorbitantly expensive goggles, the name of which I have forgotten, the Vision Pro Plus.
Apple Vision Pro.
That sounds good. And that's obviously a very big splash in the market, something that has been largely quite a niche product, even though I know Sony PlayStation has been in the space. But Apple entering it certainly does change the equation. So let's look at beyond the screens that we know and love at the moment. What is coming next, Erica?
Well, I think it's this idea of embodied technology. And in fact, if you ask a couple of my friends, we've gone, at the moment we're in the wearable, but the future is the hidden tech. It's the idea that, is it just going to be like special contact lenses and we can't even tell that people have these screens? I think it's hard enough to tell when people are using, even if it's just like a wearable, like hearing aids can actually have Bluetooth that talk to your phone now. So the number of times that, you know, I've had a relative talking to someone on the phone and I'm like, what? You're not near your phone. What? Who are you talking to? Have you lost your marbles? But I think it's this idea that the tech and the screen goes with us. But I don't know if it's a great idea, because I feel like having them separate can help us to be able to actually focus on what's at hand. This idea of multitasking everywhere all the time, they actually came out and told people not to wear Vision Pro goggles driving their Teslas. I mean, what kind of world do we live in?
There's a bad natural selection joke in there that I'm going to choose to avoid. Yeah. I mean, if you have to be told not to wear your virtual reality headsets while in your electric robot car, I just feel like the universe is telling us something. For you, Alice, is there something beyond the realm of screens as we know it that is exciting you, or, just to give you both options, terrifying you and we should all avoid like the plague?
Well, before I tell you that bit, I was just going to say that I have actually used the Apple Vision Pro and I really liked it. Apple flew me to their Worldwide Developers Conference last year, and it was like, I got to try it and it was really cool, and it's the most impressive VR I've ever used. But also, and like, I want one, but I don't think it's going to become anyone's normal everyday wearing. It is uncomfortable as hell. It is weirdly dystopian seeing the Uncanny Valley, like, Avatar people talk on it. Like, I want it to watch movies on the plane.
Yeah, I'm down. That's 100% why I
want to play games in it. I want to use it as a mobile workspace. But I can't imagine a world where people other than the weirdos who believe in self-driving would actually ever wear it other than when they're just like traveling or at home a bit. Like, it's not that kind of device. I don't think any VR headset is going to take off in that kind of way until it is light and comfortable and there is a proper use case for it.
I think there's space for future technology that is not the killer app, most popular version of a technology. I mean, even though Apple have made MacBooks and iPhones, they also still make high-powered, heavy-duty hardware that's just for coders or editors and things like that. And I tend to think that the Vision Pro falls into that category. Personally, my interest in it is I'd like to be able to edit television with it. Like, I'd like to be able to have a really huge array of screens in front of me, be able to edit massive amounts of TV content. I'd love to be able to do that. That'd be fascinating.
That's what I'd be grateful for.
Yeah, but whereas I have no intention of getting behind the wheel of a Tesla.
Yeah.
Not that I have a Tesla, but you know what I mean? Like, that just seems like not a great use of anyone's brain space.
And I see all these people say, oh, no, it's going to be such a dystopian future. There's going to be people walking around and, like, the Vision Pro will change how they see the streets and they will live in their own individualized world. I'm like, have you tried to wear this for an hour and walk around and stand up? You will then immediately understand that this is not going to be a future problem. This is a fun device. It's cool. It's just like some of the other VR headsets I've tried. Like, have you ever played Beat Saber? It's awesome. But I'm not taking that to the streets when I go to Woolies. Like,
is it the sort of thing that, like, you mentioned that it's heavy as hell. If you were just sitting down with a pillow behind your head, would it still be painful and annoying after a while?
So the problem that I had was that it was really heavy on my cheekbones. And I got to do this really cool demo where this butterfly flew in and it landed on my finger, and it was so realistic that I felt it land on my finger, and it was a magical experience for me that I have been talking about nonstop ever since. But, like, I could really tell that I was wearing a headset. At no point did the headset disappear, because it is a miracle of engineering. It's still heavy. And until they work out a way of taking it off your face and then putting the computing into another device, which would then make it much less portable, it is not going to be comfortable.
In terms of talking about other devices, they already have the power cable and the battery is separate, which to me is one big issue for usability. But you're right. It needs to have its specific cases. And I get asked this because we've got this incredible space. So we've got a room that's like 3D and it's like 360 all the way around you. And people are like, oh, wow, how do you use that in your teaching, Erica? And I'm like, are you kidding? I don't need to see code that big. I'm not that blind. So the places that we use it for nursing simulations where you can actually see 3D models. We use it for walkthroughs of engineering plants so they can actually see what the building is going to look like and perhaps find some errors beforehand. So I think part of the challenge is getting it out of the techie hands and into the people who actually could do something useful with it. But for me, I mean, I'm such a klutz just wearing my normal glasses. I can't imagine trying to walk around with something that heavy and that vision restricting.
As we look beyond the future of screens, as we know, the 14 of them I have in front of me right now, Erica, for you, as we look beyond screens we have today, what's the thing you're most excited about?
I think for me, I'm going for augmented reality rather than virtual reality. Mm. I like the idea, like I'm still wishing that Google Glass hadn't just like completely died out because there were some good use cases there. Like, you know, the mechanic that can open the engine and go, oh, it's that part that's broken and get it ordered. You know, I'm all for AI or, you know, our vision screens actually making life better. So I think to make life better, yeah, it needs to be lighter. It needs to be bit more seamless so that you can interact with the world around you when appropriate as well as with the tech. So to me, it's all about that augmented reality rather than the purely virtual.
And for you, Alice, what are you most excited about in the future beyond the screens we currently have?
So at CES this year, both LG and Samsung announced transparent televisions. Like it was just a piece of glass and then it was an OLED TV. And I thought that was amazing because I've always wanted like a really giant TV that doesn't just like take over my whole wall with black, but I don't have to deal with the fiddliness of a projector. So when it stops being like $100,000, I'm going to be super into that. But I think the most important thing we need to be working on now is not necessarily new revolutionary tech that fixes a problem we don't necessarily know we have, but technology that lowers barriers for people with accessibility needs. Because we're creating a lot of technology that does not necessarily always bring along people with vision problems or problems with their hearing or physical problems like limb differences or something. We're not properly taking people into account, which is weird when at some point, if you're lucky enough to get old, you will have an accessibility need. So I think, yeah, the thing that I'm excited about is the increased focus on accessibility from some game companies and definitely the major phone companies, and how that's going to translate to a more interesting internet and connected world.
To the future of screens, huge thank you to our guests this week. Alice Clark, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Erica Mealy, thank you as ever.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed the program, please make sure you leave a review on whichever podcasting app you happen to listen to us on. And of course, this and all of your favorite ABC podcasts are available all the time in perpetuity on ABC Listen. My name is Mark Fennell and I will catch you next week for another episode of Download This Show.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.